Hello all, welcome to the first episode of Marco Talks. We have with us Dr. Prashant Kocharlakota Garu, one of the leading psychologists in India with an experience of 32 years. Dr. Prashant was born and raised in the United States and had a quite long and interesting life. He underwent a lot of medical training and switched fields to psychopathology in 1994. Being a relatively new field, it was available only 2 to 3 states then. He moved back to India in 2010 after the global economic crisis. Being a psychopathologist, he was able to harness the power of both therapy and medicine, which contributes to his success today. His journey of emerging as one of the best in the field that was relatively young when he started out is quite an inspiration to the younger generation. It's a pleasure to have you, sir. To kickstart our talk, we'd like to ask the most basic question of all. What is the difference between psychology and psychiatry?
And PhD. So, very, very simple. If a person has a diploma, DPM, diploma or MD, MBBS, they're going to go into psychiatry. In India, psychiatrists very rarely perform psychotherapy. I'll get to psychologists. The reason is that the money is less. If you're going to take a 1 hour session with a patient, you can't charge him what you would. You know, 1,000 rupees for treatment, you can't charge him that much. You can, and they will come, but the training is not there. And the fault lies in people like me. We didn't train the younger generation in terms of how to do psychotherapy. Psychotherapy is I don't know how to say it as a very rational person. It's a very sacred thing. A patient sits before you. It's not about medication. Now we're coming to psychology. With psychiatry, it's about medication. It's chemical. The relationship between the patient and the doctor is one of, it's brief. It's about 10 to 15 minutes. And the doctor has at his disposal maybe certain number of antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, antipsychotics, whatever, we have thousands of different medications, and that is what they will use to reduce the pain, the emotional pain of the patient. Now, if you go to a psychologist, they can't write a prescription. They will try to do it with talk therapy, it's called. Okay? The psychiatrist uses medical therapy, the psychologist uses talk therapy. They try to investigate where was the first trauma. At least that is what the theory is. I'm finding, unfortunately, I hope people don't mistake me, but as a more senior person, in India in psychology, people are not practicing it with the commitment and dedication they should have. So people are coming, they're giving them tests, they show them photos and pictures and everything, which is fine. But if I have let's say a young lady of 17 years and she's breaking down and she's cutting her wrist, it's actually not that unusual. She's depressed, she's not able to sleep. I don't need to show her photographs or pictures and her to describe those pictures. So what's happened is it's become very rigid, psychologically. What a person has to do is, and this is where I'm at fault, a psychologist has to practice the art of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy. There are at least maybe 20, 30 different types of psychotherapy, depending on the patient. Okay, so the problem is that there are no gurus. Because the gurus also practice the same type of, you know, approach. So I'm trying to, at least my students, my limited number of students, teach them how psychotherapy is done. To summarize your answer, the question, psychiatry is a medical profession. It depends on neuroleptics, SSRIs, sedative serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antipsychotic medications to heal the patient's problem. Now, what if your problem is not a medication problem? You're still going to get a medication. You may get dependent on that medication. Psychologists, when you go to the psychologist, I'm reversing my original position. They're going to start counseling you. What if you need medication? What if you're so depressed that you actually need medication to prevent you from harming yourself? Psychologist will not give it to you. If they come back next week, that's the difference between the two things.
While working as a consultant for criminal psychology with the United States Police Department, is there a case scenario where your expertise has changed the outcome of the case?
There was. It's difficult for me to do that without using names because those victims are still alive. So the court records are sealed, but I'll give you an example of one. You know, a lot of people always say that I can read somebody, right? We were talking about this earlier, same way. I thought I could do that. I thought I could understand people. I thought I could figure out people. My mentor was a deputy chief of forensics for Massachusetts State Police. A 6 foot tall man, naval officer, white beard, very, very impressive person. He was my guru, my mentor. And when he was sort of, he wanted me to take over a case, he introduced me to to the case, which was that there was a serial rape. It was a large number of college students, female college students, who were being raped. And for some reason, because the college also had a large number of, equally large number of male students, it was very difficult. There are political consequences also. In forensic psychology, let me just explain forensic when you use that word. It just means law. So if I say forensic medicine, it means the law with medicine. If I say forensic accounting, the law with accounting. Okay, there's a legal aspect of those things. So he had trained me for quite some time and he asked me to meet this person that they caught. And I was expecting a person who was, how should I say it, a monster. I met a person who is maybe 23 years old, baby face. I wanted to rescue him, in fact. He was very polite, you know, he cried, he said, I didn't do these things, I don't know why they're doing it. There was in forensics and psychology, there's a technique that I had developed, which was the way each of us does A, the letter A, is the way that we're going to do B, okay? Now, the way that we do A and B is the way that we are going to do C. The way that we, and you can carry on from there, right? So, if I want to know, let's say for example, somebody had crashed into a car or whatever else, I'll say, bring me his motorcycle. Because the way he drives his motorcycle is going to be the way he drives his car, okay? If someone drives really fast on a highway and they don't care about they see a family, a big Wagoner, whatever it is, full of children and everything, and they brush very close and everything and they go, I can assume something about this person. I can also assume that his room, wherever he's staying, with a roommate or without a roommate, there's a lot of impulsivity. Clothes are taken and thrown on the ground. Okay? If his driving is very aggressive, this is going to sound very strange to you, but what I asked for at that time, I said, we can't get a warrant for anything other than a toothbrush. Toothbrush, hairbrush, nothing. I said, get me the toothbrush of this person. I already knew that the toothbrush this person uses is going to be, imagine using a toothbrush for the same toothbrush for 3 or 4 years. Completely flattened. This is a brand new toothbrush this guy used. And it was completely crushed. He pressed so hard. Aggression. Okay. So we were able to, again, what is A leads to B, what is A and B leads to C. So in a situation like that, I was not directly responsible for catching him there. We have police officers or whatever. But joining with the police and giving my input, that was an important case. I think it was Edward Maynard. He was not just serial rapist, he had killed also whoever he had raped. I'm sorry if that you know, triggers anybody, but it was not just my work, but it was many, many police officers. But for my part, it was these, it's called signature profiling. In my family, sometimes somebody, when I was in the US, they'd say, well, you know, shadi ka rishta hai, pedi chup lo chai, somebody wants to get married, the boy is coming, or the girl is coming. And I said, Prashant, you sit and you watch. Don't say anything. So, you know, it's like an orchestra, each behavior. This is the truth, this is what it is. I'm seeing all of you in five different small cubes on the top of the my monitor. Each of you, suppose I plaster your mouth, okay? Not painfully. I plaster your mouth very lovingly, very gently. And I tie your hands, I bind your hands, okay? And I even put a plaster over your eyes. I guarantee you, if I ask you a question, you will communicate. The eyebrows will go up and down, okay, something like that. You'll have a reaction. So, for example, in forensics, what we would do is we'd have a person, you'd think that, you know, people are very clever. Suppose a detective is conducting interrogation. Some smell from the crime, maybe a certain type of flower, maybe leather, maybe burnt tires, maybe he pushed her off the road and the tires burned. We'll have that pushed into the interrogation room and see the reaction of the person. See, your senses don't deceive you. Your facial muscles, they're called micro-expressions, you can't be deceived. If I take something, let's say a big heavy stapler, and I act like I'm throwing it at you, suddenly you react. As prepared as you may be, you are going to react. That is a micro-expression. People say, I can fake the micro-expression. Oh, not that type of micro, not the faking type. Not the Shah Rukh Khan, not the N.T. Ramarao type. It's a kind of micro-expression which is instinctive. Okay, and that is what you look for when you're questioning somebody, when you're investigating something. So that's when they bring in psychologists. I think the long answer I gave you was that would be my role. Not to question the person, but to just observe. I'll write out the question and I would watch what kind of reactions they would give.
I came across an interesting piece of article which said all our cousins, like the great apes, the monkeys, have black sclera, whereas we humans have a white sclera. And the article said that all of our communications have evolved based on the opposite person being able to track our eye movements. Do you think we having a white sclera and, you know, developing our language around eye movements was one of the contributing factors for, you know, for the successful establishment of human race?
Many Darwinian people who are geneticists, biologists, Richard Dawkins, Darwinian biologist, evolutionary biologist, most evolutionary biologists say this, that you can't pick any one thing. Our ability to track is not just based on, that's a good question, by the way. It's an excellent question. We are where we are because of this, the opposable thumb, this prefrontal lobe. This prefrontal lobe tells us what to do and what not to do. In animals, it's not there. It might be there. It is there in some animals. But they do what's impulsive. They have children, they steal. You know, people, when you think of a chimpanzee, can I ask you, would you think of a chimpanzee as being violent or being very peaceful? Very peaceful, right? Chimpanzees, bonobos, they are some of the most violent species on the earth. They have wiped out other tribes. The reason is because one of the other tribe came into their location. This has been going on for hundreds of thousands of years. The whole thing is that we have certain skills, and you know what that is, that skill? It's not just about being able to trace, it's not our eyes, it's not that we can see better, it's not that we use our body better. It's that because of this prefrontal lobe, the prefrontal lobe is the part of your body which tells you whether you should do something or not do something. For example, you're about to cross a road. Traffic is quite heavy, okay? Your prefrontal lobe tells you, look, you know how to cross this road. You've got headphones in, you're relaxed. You cross roads like this with your motorcycle, you're a hero. You're a heroine, okay? Suddenly, one day your prefrontal lobe says, not today. Not today, just wait for the traffic to die down, then you cross. Okay, your prefrontal lobe is the one that tells you that you're going to talk to someone. You see a respected professor or a colleague or a friend, you see them sitting and eating in the canteen, whatever, and you want to go and talk to them. The prefrontal lobe says, not today, something about the body language, everything else, it's protective. It is there. The way they're sitting is the way an ape would sit when they don't want to be approached. It's primitive knowledge, okay? It's knowledge that's over the millennia. So the whole thing is that we have this super brain, this prefrontal cortex right here, which tells us what to do and what not to do. And we have this neocortex, philosophy, mathematics, everything else. So animals, chimpanzees are our cousins. They are not our ancestors. They are a certain branch that's our ancestors, but they are our cousins. And this is the biggest thing that I tell my students. Sometimes my students come and say, Auntie sir, this person hurt my feelings. And I said, who hurt your feelings? And they said, this person. I said, well, what are they? I said, he's a human being. He's a doctor. He's this. I said, who told you he's a human being? No, we know, we human beings are human beings. I said, who called us human beings? Who gave that very great title, the Maharaja who said, told his people that he's a Maharaja, that kind of thing. We are primates, we're apes. We are still apes. If you take a person, try and attack him, insult him, or you frighten him, really frighten him, see what happens. His behavior will become, when you say primitive, right? What does primitive mean? Like a primate. You all of you see it every single day. You see primitive behavior. You see it more often among those who are maybe dishonest, putting the work on others, lying, whatever it is. We don't blame those people. Once you become psychologist or psychopathologist or psychiatrist, you begin to understand the patterns, you begin to understand the reason why they behave that way. Okay, the amygdala, the part of the brain which creates fear, if they're caught, you know, the terrible fear, the terror, that's why they have to lie to get. Once someone asked me, why do people lie so much? I said, so they don't get caught, that's it. But in their childhood, they had somebody who tortured them. In this case, I don't know if this answered the question or not. There is no particular strength that we have. Socially, we are just like the apes. They are very good socially. They get along with each other. Okay. Intellectually, we are of course far superior to the apes. But they are able to do certain things that we cannot do. In most areas, we are like apes. We are apes. And when you think of that, the next time you get hurt by somebody's behavior, remind yourself, I am dealing with other apes, other animals. We're called human animals rather than human beings. Say, I am dealing with human animals. How do animals behave? What's the description of animals? They are unpredictable. They can be violent. They can be self-serving. It's about them, not others. Meaning they're not altruistic. They don't do it for the sake, you know, for the sake of the whole tribe, I'll give up my life, none of that stuff. They are concerned with their own children. They will kill another for the sake of protecting their own children. Does that sound familiar to you all? It's human beings.
So you told something about, you know, when you see a person sitting at a table and eating, you know, he protects himself in a way which we decide that we shouldn't approach him. Like, that is what the gut feeling is, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Where does the gut feeling arise from? Is it the same prefrontal cortex or something else?
In the gut. The gut feeling arises in the gut. And the problem is that most people disregard their gut feeling. Your gut or your stomach has hundreds of billions of neural endings, okay? Just like your brain. Think of it as your second brain. That's why when you're about to talk to someone, maybe a professor, a lecturer, you're about to write an exam, your stomach, it's called butterflies in the stomach, right? Okay? It's basically telling you, don't do this. This is not good for you. But if you really are able to get in tune with that gut feeling, you'll develop what's called intuition. Some people say when you go to their house, there's a dog there, very big Alsatian or something like that. You'll say, no, I'm afraid of dogs. Okay? They say, no, don't be afraid because it can sense fear. You've been told that, right? Don't be afraid because it can sense fear. So at times like that, human beings, other people that you meet also can sense what you feel about them. There is a very beautiful thing I learned, and you are going to love this, okay, all the viewers and listeners. Did you know that when you meet a person, they can tell how you feel about them? You've all been to maybe some social gatherings, maybe marriages, some parties, okay, medical students, I don't know how many parties you go to, maybe more. But the point is that you mix with other people, right? You see a professor and suddenly he's not so whatever polite. People can tell how you feel about them. We act, face. We act, we put on a mask, we try to say certain things and do things to convince the other person. But in reality, people can tell. Don't you, right now as I'm saying that, don't think about yourself. When you meet somebody and they shake your hand and they say, nice to meet you. And they are looking at their watch. Maybe not looking at their watch, that's too much. Okay? But the smile, the eyes don't smile, something. Something will tell you, this person is the last thing they want to do right now, is sit and talk to me. They are not attracted to me. They are not interested in me. They don't want anything to do with me. So what happens is, when you meet people, make sure you program your mind to say, this is something I do very often. Because I meet 5, 6, 7, 8 people in a day, some people will be very angry. So I tell them that these are my children and they're coming in, they don't know that they are my children. And when they walk into my room, there's a feeling, sometimes a very great emotion. And as hard as they are, as whatever they may have done in their life, whatever they're going through, there's a connection. The reason is because there are mirror neurons in our brain. Okay? So if I take a pin and start pressing it into my hand, what do you do? You don't say, let's see how far the pin will go. You can't. Not guesses, young doctors. You'll say, you have a visceral reaction. You feel it here. Don't press it. I have nothing in my finger. There's nothing in this finger, nothing happening here. But when I start pressing it, you say, don't do that. Because you can't feel the pain. But the mirror neurons in your brain, they feel it. This is where altruism comes from. I mean, do good for others, care for them. You see someone on the road who is begging, who is starving. It's those mirror neurons that say, do for them so that you don't end up like that. It's actually very scientific. It's not a spiritual or philosophical thing. It's deeply, deeply scientific.
Also, sir, is there any particular case which made you ponder over the complexity of human mind and made you question whether the world's progress over the understanding of human psychology is enough?
It was not actually my own case. It was one of my very dear friends is a very well-known social psychologist. She's an Indian lady, about 60 years old. She came to India and she wrote a book. She wrote a book and she sent the book to me. And she's written the same book, same type of book. I mean, she goes to different parts, villages, cities, everything. She wrote about in the US, she went to UK, Europe, Africa, South America and everything. And one thing she said is very interesting. She said, we human beings are very, very occupied with our own survival. We are very survival oriented. We are very much, we are almost obsessed with acquiring things. And we want more technology which we cannot use. We don't know how to use it. And human beings, what I have noticed is this. In 32 years, now it's going to be almost 33 years of day-to-day practice. There's no vacation. I don't take vacations. I don't, you know, one of my students say, when do you take a break? Last time I took a holiday was in 1991. The reason I'm saying that is this. My work is so interesting that I don't need a vacation, you know. It's hearing about people and what they're going through. There's no judgment. Before, Ranta, I like your question because I first have to say this. There's no judgment. These people are bad, those people are good, what they did is wrong. Nothing like that. It's human suffering, human pain. I think the one thing I realize is this. We have a huge brain, that is, neocortex is there, but we have technology which we don't know how to use yet. You know, how many people can build a Boeing 747? Very few people, you know, 0.0001% of the people. How many people can build the latest MacBook? Very few people. Steve Jobs, not even him, he didn't know how to build it. His engineers knew how to build it. How many people know how to perform robotic neurosurgery? Very few. But we all behave, we all interact on this earth as if we can all do those things. The truth is that we are about 1,000 to 2,000 to maybe 3,000 years behind, okay, in terms of the capacity of our brain, the competence of the human brain, the ability of the human brain, okay. We are almost 2,000 to 3,000 years behind those few people who invent something. Look at how many people have iPhones or Android. We don't know what goes into building these things. So what I'm trying to say is that curiosity has died down, it's changed. And I think that we have to understand that most human beings are struggling with the basic day-to-day lives. How do I get married? You talk to a 25-year-old man. Okay, I'm going to take some time to answer this question. Sorry. I'm going to give it brief if I can. I find a 5-year-old boy. I say, beta, how do you like life? Are you happy? And he'll say, uncle, I want to go into 7th class. Then I'll be happy. Say, oh, okay. 7th class. 12th, you'll be 7th class. You'll be 12 years old. Okay. Now I failed to find that same boy in 7th class. The beta, are you happy now? Uncle, no, I want to go to Narayana Chaitanya, you know, they're all co-educational, then I'll be happy. And I say, now I find him in Narayana Chaitanya. Are you happy now, beta? And uncle, I want to get into medical college. I said, okay, beta. And I find him 3-4 years in medical college, just like all of you. Are you happy now, beta? And he said, no, uncle, I want to do PG. Okay, PG, are you happy now? No, I want to get into it. So, he's now working at some hospital, Apollo, or whatever, you know, Yashoda or something, okay? Gandhi, Usmania, if possible, if he's lucky, he'll get into Usmania, okay? He's working at Usmania, okay? I say, beta, are you happy now? And he says, uncle, I want to have a private practice. Now, this guy's 50 years old. I said, I said, beta? He says, no, bhaiya. I said, okay, bhaiya, sorry, you're my age now. Are you happy? You have a private practice. He says, no, you know, I want to take my family to Switzerland. How many Indians ski in Switzerland? We don't know how to ski. They want to go to Switzerland. He's gone to Switzerland, come back. I said, what do you want next? He says, I want children. Okay, now he's got 2.5 children. You know, two kids and a dog, that's 2.5, right? So, and a wife. Now he's got a big bungalow in Gachibowli, working there somewhere in some corporate hospital. I said, now are you happy? You finally reached everything that you wanted to have. He said, I want to retire. You know, I want to see my children having children. I want to retire. By the way, one of the things he wanted in there was, I want to get married. But I didn't want to comment on that, okay? He says, now I want to retire. Now I find him sitting on a, standing on a terrace. He's 80 years old, and I say, bhaiya, no. He says, Baba. I said, Baba, are you happy now? He said, you know, when I was happy, when you found me first time, I was in first class. There is no real happiness. So the truth is this, okay, Nandita, you asked me a very important question. This is the most important question, answer I can ever give in today. Become comfortable with discomfort. Become comfortable with pain. Become comfortable with sadness, with fear, with anxiety, with confusion. Most people go to everybody and say, no, is there life after death? Will I be born as this? Will I be? Become comfortable with those things, not having the answers. And if you can do that, becoming comfortable with pain, physical pain, human, emotional pain, the life that you'll have will be amazing.
Thanks a lot for the wonderful talk, sir. We'll call it a day and continue our discussion next week.